I'm Francis Seeley from GlobalNet 21, and I'd like to welcome you to this podcast today. This is one podcast that we do in a series of podcasts that tackle major issues that we all face in our society. And today we're going to talk about public health. And at the time of this particular pandemic, it's a really, really important topic to talk about because everyone's concerned about public health. And we've got Charlotte Gath, who's going to join us today, and she is a retired GP. I think she'll tell us about herself anyhow. And she's also been someone who's advising the particular county council around public health. So I'm glad you're here to talk about this topic today, Charlotte. And maybe we could begin by you first telling us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, well, thank you. And I'm delighted to be here with you. So I'm speaking to you from rural Warwickshire. And as you say, I'm a doctor, actually, and I worked in both general practice and public health. And I had a 30-year career which went from one to the other and back again. So I trained in public health and then subsequently in general practice as well. And I've worked across both fields. But latterly, I worked as a consultant in public health for Warwickshire County Council for about 5 years. And then I actually took early retirement just over 2 years ago, and I became a carer for my mother, who has dementia. So I did that then. But I basically had about a 30-year career in public health and general practice.
Okay, well, that's quite a background that you've had. Okay, so we're going to talk about public health, and we use the term a lot, and people sometimes don't know what it exactly means. Do you want to tell us what we mean by public health?
Okay. Well, the most common thing I always found is that people think it's something to do with drains. That's what always the response you get is that something to do with drains? Which I think is confusing it with environmental health. But public health, if I could just read to you just briefly, and I won't read to you very much, but it's the official definition that Sir Donald Acheson came up with about 20 years ago, was the art and science of preventing disease, prolonging life, and promoting health through the organised efforts of society. And nobody's come up with a better definition than that. That's kind of what we do. And when I try and explain it to people, I always say it's like, it's not taking responsibility for the health of an individual, it's taking responsibility for the health of a population. So for example, at one stage in my career, I was responsible for the health of the people of Northampton. So that's a population of 200,000 people. And so you take overall responsibility for their health as a group of people rather than caring for individuals.
Okay, but when we talk about that's fine. But when we talk about public health, we're talking about, aren't we, both physical and mental health?
We are. I'm just going to take a step back, actually. I mean, you're right, it is physical and mental health. But there are kind of, just to explain a bit further what public health actually is and what we do, there's kind of three strands to it. So there's the kind of what we call health protection, which is the bit that is really in the news at the moment. So that's the bit about protection from communicable disease, infectious disease, environmental hazards, that sort of thing. So that's health protection. Then there's disease prevention and health improvement. So that's about improving people's health. And that's a bit where physical and mental health comes in. So we're talking about improving people's health by reducing risk factors and improving their health and well-being. And the third very broad strand is sort of management of health services. So that's health care. And that includes sort of commissioning services, managing services, that sort of thing. So it's sort of those three strands make up the whole specialty of public health.
But the way you describe it, it obviously sounds very important. And in the time of this pandemic, it, you know, is important in everybody's mind. So if it is so important and, you know, preventing risk, why is it often the poor cousin in health policy?
I think, well, lots of reasons. I think one I would say is to do with short-termism, because the kind of outcomes that we achieve in public health, where you improve people's health in broad terms, tend to be longer term. And quite often, certainly governments think in sort of short-term electoral 5-year programmes, that sort of thing. And so the NHS has always been, I guess, skewed towards funding priorities within the acute sector, within hospitals. And people who make the most noise about, basically. And public health, because it does tend to work to longer time frames, tends to get moved aside. And then I think beyond that, there's something about ideology, because if you look at the kind of things that have been priorities in public health, certainly when I first got involved, back in, this was 1980 when I was a student in my first year at UCL, the Black Report was published. And some people may remember that, but the Black Report was produced by, well, Black, basically. And it basically was about how to reduce inequalities in health and how to improve the health of children. And one of its key recommendations was that actually giving children milk at school improves the health of children. And to me, that was such a kind of, you know, like a sort of a moment where I changed my thinking, because up until then I was sort of thinking about hospitals and patients and that sort of thing. And then I got that interest from then much more broadly in sort of health and the things that we can do. So what I was going to say was that at that time, that report was suppressed, actually. It was by Mrs. Thatcher. She just didn't want to hear about it, and it was put on one side and it was never actioned. And then we come around to sort of 2008, the Labour government then commissioned Professor Sir Michael Marmot to do a very big review of the health of the population. So he was looking at life expectancy and measuring all sorts of things to do with health and life expectancy and how people do. And he produced a major report that was published in 2010, by which time we had a Conservative government who initially welcomed it, but then actually didn't take any action on it at all. And that's partly to do with a decade of austerity and, you know, other things, but partly to do with politics and health inequalities not being flavour of the month, as it were. Yeah, so a whole decade has gone by. And then Sir Michael Marmot produced another report in 2020, just in February, which has got subsumed by COVID and the pandemic. But what I'm saying is I think successive governments have either deprioritised it because of the pressures of hospitals, the acute sector, money, that sort of thing, or being ideologically just not in favour of doing anything about health inequalities.
Yeah, well, OK, I remember my milk at school as well. But I'm just wondering, you know, you say it's because of short-termism and so on, but surely governments of any persuasion realise that the more you have an effective public health service, the less strain it puts on the hospitals and the GPs.
I think up to a point they do. Yes, I'd agree. I mean, and that's why we've had funding for things like tobacco cessation programmes, so to help people stop smoking. We have funding around sexual health programmes. And yes, I think governments do recognise that a good public health system and effective prevention systems prevent the load on first on primary care and subsequently on secondary care. And certainly things like reducing risk factors for heart disease, for stroke, those sort of things have been very effective.
Do you think, though, that now we've had this COVID-19 epidemic and we still have it, that has made people realise more the importance of public health and has also shown up its deficiencies as well?
Absolutely. Well, I think there's two sides to public health that have been highlighted by the pandemic. I mean, firstly, most people never knew anything about the sort of communicable disease element and control of a pandemic or any of that. And clearly that's reached a higher profile than I've ever seen before. And it's been slightly surreal seeing sort of former colleagues and people that I trained with on the news and on Newsnight, you know, night after night, talking about public health, because that's never happened before that I can remember. So yes, certainly a high new profile. But beyond that, as you say, the sort of public health aspects to how has lockdown affected people's health, how has COVID affected people's health apart from the viral infection, what's going to happen after lockdown, how do we improve people's health subsequently, and how do we help people recover? That also is a big strand of what public health is all about. So I think you're right that the profile of public health has enormously increased, but the different scope of what public health is and does has also become recognised.
So it looks at prevention, and it looks at you know, how you can deal with the situation after. I mean, I gather I read there was a report 2 years ago that said that planning for a possible pandemic was really bad, and the report was never published. I mean, that it showed there wasn't this planning and there was a lack of risk assessment that there should be. I mean, does that surprise you?
Well, I think the bit that you mentioned was the exercise that was called Exercise Cygnus, which was in that was in 2016, and it was a big national exercise involving sort of social care, the NHS, senior managers, prison officers, and ministers, looking at what would happen in the event of an influenza pandemic. And as you say, there are a number of recommendations that came out of that. And a number of them just weren't implemented. And that includes the sort of, you know, the stockpiling of PPE, the potential protection for care homes and things that have been highlighted subsequently. I think prior to that, you know, we already had experience of some pandemics. There was the H1N1 flu outbreak epidemic, which was in 2012. Before that, we'd had experience of SARS and Ebola. And, you know, there have been other kinds of communicable diseases that have spread extensively and for which governments have had to respond and develop subsequent planning. And indeed, the WHO had a whole series of reports about preparedness for flu and for influenza pandemics. But I think one of the things that's been highlighted to all of us is that the preparedness for countries, especially this country, was all around flu. Coronavirus is different from flu. And it has a higher case fatality rate and many more people who are infectious, but not necessarily identified because they're asymptomatic. And so COVID basically has hit us worse. Serious viral infections like SARS and MERS, which is sort of basically the Asian countries, responded better, more quickly and more effectively than we did. So, you know, I think that shows the flu was not necessarily the answer that we needed in coronavirus pandemic.
I mean, that's one of the criticisms that's been made of the government, that it planned it like it was going to be flu and then discovered exactly. It wasn't. Yeah. I mean, is that understandable, or should they have realised that pandemics can be different things? I mean, Bill Gates warned about this many, many years ago.
He did, yeah. I think it was reasonable to use the sort of flu modelling initially. I think that was fair enough. But I think what happened in this country is that we were slow to respond to the changes that were being picked up in both China and in Italy. And we should just have responded more quickly. And I think it's clear from, you know, where there have been people from SAGE and from the so-called independent SAGE who've said quite clearly, you know, that if we had locked down more quickly, we could potentially have saved lives at that stage. So I think there was the question about timing of response. I don't think it was unreasonable to use flu modelling initially, but it was, I think we should have responded much more quickly when we began to realise that it was a different kind of virus that we were dealing with.
So there's the planning for the different types of viruses that we might be exposed to, but there's also the delivery of public health. And it's one of the problems there that it depends upon a whole series of statutory bodies and voluntary bodies, and that collaboration is difficult.
I think, you're right that it has been kind of fragmented, but I think that's actually essentially what we're trained to do in a public health training. We're taught to work across between the voluntary sector, between the NHS, between local authorities, and to try and work in all kinds of settings in a sort of multi-sectoral way. So I do think that's part of what public health is and what we're supposed to do. There was obviously a big change in 2012, you know, when public health moved with the Andrew Lansley's reforms from the NHS and into local authorities, which, you know, had arguments both ways, because for many people that meant that we had the influence over the much wider sort of social determinants of health. So that's sort of housing, education, social care. And that was very valuable to have that input and to work directly with local authorities. But on the other hand, it slightly distanced public health from the NHS, and that's had its downsides as well. So, I think your point's very valid, but I think that is exactly what public health is supposed to do, to work across all the sectors and try and work effectively in joining people up.
And how easy do the statutory bodies find it to work with the voluntary bodies, not necessarily the management level, but down at the ground level, at the network level where it matters? And are they given the freedom to make decisions there without having to be involved in a bureaucracy?
I'm not sure about that, because there is a kind of bureaucracy, because if, for example, services are being commissioned by the local authority from the voluntary sector, there will be that whole tier of sort of what commissioning means and a kind of management role in that, which does rather kind of formalise the whole process of working together. But in my experience, people work very well, you know, as you say, at ground level and delivery and service delivery, people work together because we have the same sort of shared ideas and aims of what we're trying to do. And those sort of barriers to do with different sectors actually can be broken down relatively easily when you work together.
Yeah, and I mean, the voluntary sector is pretty crucial, aren't they? I mean, the statutory bodies, although they're set up, they're paid, they're professional, they can't do it alone, can they?
No, and I think increasingly we've become dependent on the voluntary sector, actually. I mean, just on a sort of personal level, I work in a food bank, and look at the fact that we actually rely on the Trussell Trust to supply food to people, and that, you know, that never happened a decade ago, but now that's just kind of taken as read and accepted. When I was working as a consultant in public health, we were very reliant on the voluntary sector as well, because a lot of the work I did was around mental health. We used to work with Rethink and Mind, Age UK, Alzheimer's Society, and work very directly with them on our sort of commission services on mental health and wellbeing. So I think the voluntary sector have been key at every stage.
And indeed, in this pandemic, it was the voluntary sector who stepped up very quickly while the statutory bodies were still planning what to do. So in a way, they filled a gap at the beginning.
Well, I think, to be fair, a lot of what the local authorities could have been doing and the statutory bodies has been kind of stripped away in terms of resource and people. I mean, even things, one of my former professors that I worked with some years ago, I gave an example just recently about the free school meals for children. You know, in up until not that long ago, when people were trying to access, if head teachers were trying to access free school meals for children in a crisis like this, they would have got in touch with somebody locally. But now it's all centralised and it goes through a kind of online system, and it's actually much more difficult to access. And head teachers were complaining about that early on. And that actually, there's all sorts of examples of that, that the way that things worked fairly effectively locally has been stripped down, centralised and made more difficult to access. And that just, it just makes it much harder for everybody.
So how could you possibly reverse that and have more decentralisation?
I think one of the things that will be very clearly demonstrated by this pandemic is that circumventing the local services has not helped anybody. And I think it's why the government really are in a mess around things like the test and tracing system, because they ignored initially primary care. So that's GPs, practice nurses, all sorts of people who could and should have been involved in this, and directors of public health. And there were existing public health teams, people who work in sexual health, work in sort of contact tracing all the time. You know, there were plenty of resources that they could have used to get a test and trace system up and running quite quickly that would have worked effectively in the local community and would have been integrated with the existing NHS services. But they chose to go through a sort of, you know, for what reason, I just can't think really, but to go through getting Serco to set something up from scratch, which, you know, has just caused all sorts of problems.
Yeah, I mean, many people say you shouldn't set things up from scratch, you should replicate what is good, and there is so much that's good out there.
Especially, yeah, if you have it already, why not use it? And we know it works well. It's just that the problem is that the local teams had shrunk and contracted severely. I think there was a review by the Health Foundation King's Fund, which showed that about 850 million has been lost from public health budgets since 2015. You know, so that's a huge amount of money, and it's a lot of people. So, you know, that was part of the problem. But I don't think that excuses deciding to set up an entirely independent test and trace system using the private sector. It just is destined for problems and destined for failure unless we can get it engaged with the local services.
Okay, well, the pandemic aside, there have been a lot of initiatives to have joined up working to work across boundaries in the public health sector. Yeah. And as a GP, I mean, you must know about social prescribing. Has that been an important initiative to try and get people to work together and have a model to do it by?
Oh, I think so. I think, I imagine anybody watching this in London, I presumably you, Francis, know about, do you know about the Bromley by Bow Health Centre?
Yeah.
Which is a pioneering health centre in Tower Hamlets, led by Sam Everington, and they basically started the whole concept of social prescribing. And for me, that was a kind of beacon of good practice, and that's kind of always what I aspired to do. But basically, it was about recognising all the sort of different determinants that impact on people's health and working out ways to support people that's not just about, you know, the direct sort of work of the GP. So it's not just about immediate health needs, but the sort of much broader things like support for training, as you say, social networks, exercise, all the sort of things that the community can effectively build around a person and support them.
And do you think that's widely practiced now, or are there still many doubters?
I think that many more people recognise the importance of it than used to. Yeah, I think people do recognise that and they value it. I think that in an ideal world, if we had still had strong public health teams and, you know, just better resources generally, we could do it better. So there's still plenty of scope to expand it and do more of it. But I think the thinking is there and the recognition is there.
Okay, the other thing is, I mean, I remember a few months ago I chaired a meeting locally on community safety for kids outside of schools. And people got up and said, we didn't know this was going on. We didn't know this was going on. They suddenly learned about new initiatives. Do you think that social mapping would help public health? If someone did some real social mapping in localities, so everyone knew that was going, what was going on, that would help, because some local authorities just don't do that.
No, I know. And well, I agree. I think it's fairly fundamental. I mean, I have to say in Warwickshire, we tended to rely on the ACAVA, the voluntary associations, to produce that kind of map of what the voluntary sector were doing, and then would sort of superimpose the kind of local authority map on it of what local authority services there were. But I think it's absolutely key. You're right. I mean, people need to know what's out there, and then there's a chance that people will use these services.
And when they do, is it important that those sort of maps are drawn with the community? In other words, it's bottom up, not top down, using something like, I don't know if you know about ABC, asset-based community development. I mean, in using those sort of models, you can find out what strengths and what gifts, as they call it, are out there in the community. How important is it that you have that bottom-up approach?
Well, I think it's vital, because otherwise you just don't get the engagement. And I've seen, you know, a few places sort of, we had, I can just think of examples in Warwickshire where we've had sort of community centres that run as wellbeing hubs. But because they've got the support and the buy-in of local people and local people engaged in how they run and that sort of thing, they're far more effective, because people value them and they feel like something, an asset that belongs to them. I think the best example of that I read recently was in a book called Poverty Safari by Darren Garvey. I don't know if you've seen that, but he basically writes about the experience of being in Glasgow, in a very deprived area in Glasgow, and people coming in and telling people what to do. You know, this is how you need to solve all your problems, and just the general resentment and resistance against that. And he describes it much more clearly than I could. There's no point in other people turning up and saying, this is how you need to solve your problems. We need to have give people an opportunity to develop their own answers and just support them in doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of work has been done on asset-based community development, and we've done webinars in the past with Cormac Russell, who's one of the main proponents of it sort of field. But what about internationally? I mean, when you look at public health, we look at the locality, we look at maybe the deficiencies at the national level, but how important is it to link up with what's happening in the rest of the world and learn from that? And to what extent is the World Health Organization central to that?
Well, I think it is central to it, because it's always been a kind of leader in terms of setting the agenda for what health needs to be about, what needs to happen globally. And I sincerely hope that they recover from this sort of fallout from the whole Trump and China issue, because it's a bit of a disaster, the threat about the loss of funding to the WHO. And incidentally, the WHO did, of course, produce a series of reports about pandemic preparedness, you know, and tried to encourage countries to get to a level of preparedness before all of this happened. And I forgot to mention, actually, just by the side, that in November 2019, the World Economic Forum rated all the countries across the world in terms of their response to that. You know, had they actually done their pandemic preparedness, and were they ready for it? And the two countries that came out top were the United States and the UK, which is rather sad in the light of, you know, 5 months later, look at where we are. But anyway, that's by the by.
We came on out on top. But some people say that very often in Britain, we have this culture of what they call British exceptionalism, that we think we should do it ourselves. And that's not the way to go, is it, for any country?
But I personally, I have to say, I have to be careful what I say, but I personally think that's exactly why we're in the mess that we're in. I mean, that the idea that it wasn't going to happen to us in those early weeks where poor Italy was struggling and suffering under the under, you know, the overwhelming of their health system in northern Italy and in Lombardy and Bergamo. And people in this country just thought it can't happen here. You know, people who should have known better and understood and recognised it. I'm not blaming epidemiologists or any of those people. I just meant our government's resistance and thinking that they didn't have to respond with any kind of pace or speed to what was happening because they just thought we don't need to. And as you say, unlocking ourselves from the European Centre for Disease Control, unlocking ourselves from the European early warning system, not going along with the joint commissioning of PPE, you know, a whole series of things where we shot ourselves in the foot precisely because of that isolationism.
So having shot ourselves in the foot, do you think that has injected into us a sense of humility now that will make us in the future realise that we've got to get the right structure set up and we've got to work internationally? Or are you pessimistic that we'll go back to the old ways of saying we'll do it ourselves?
I think, I don't know, I sort of struggle with that slightly. I don't know if you remember, do you remember early on in the pandemic at one of the government briefings where the WHO had already said about the test, and the deputy CMO at that point, Jenny Harris, said something like, well, the WHO is actually for other countries and not for us. And I think so many people had their head in their hands thinking, oh my goodness, you know, because that attitude that we are better, because actually I think in terms of international expertise, there was something about public health, you know, UK-based public health, having had, you know, a history of being very good at what we do. But clearly we've had problems this time. And I think you're absolutely right. And it's absolutely obvious to me that we will have to collaborate at a European level and beyond that globally in future for any kind of planning because of the way this has affected and impacted everybody.
So, I mean, is there any signs of optimism, though? I mean, whether the government responds, whatever colour it is, do you think there's a greater awareness amongst the general public and they're not going to let the sort of holding back and not being prepared happen again? They're aware that there is a real problem out there and that it has to be dealt with.
Well, I certainly hope so. I really hope so. I mean, I think quite a lot of people are talking about the opportunity for rebuilding public health because of what's happened and what will public health look like next, and do we have the sort of push to make it to rebuild it. I just worry slightly that, you know, since we had this thing about, you know, oh, we can't make international comparisons and, you know, the sort of nonsense that we've heard that, you know, kind of minimises the effects of what's happening here, makes it more tricky. But I think you're right. We need to try and be optimistic because I really hope that public health in its broadest sense, not just about management of virus and management of the pandemic, but the kind of, you know, what do we need to help the population recover from what's happened in every respect, you know, all the impact on people's health, mental health, physical health of lockdown and all the other effects of the pandemic, not just the virus itself, we'll need public health inputs to support people. And I hope that people do recognise that and, you know, want that to happen.
And of course, some people will argue we're going to be living from now on in a state of permanent crisis because with climate change, we're going to have a crisis continuously growing. So the need for public health is now, isn't it, more important than ever?
I think you're absolutely right, because I think certainly within the EU, I think Angela Merkel and Macron have put it like that we need to be looking towards a green and healthy recovery from COVID-19. And the opportunity to think much more collectively, much more broadly, globally, is one of the things that should come out of this pandemic, I think. And even the sort of things, you know, the images that people have seen about, you know, the clear waters in Venice and clear skies and reduced traffic and people being able to work from home more effectively. There are lots of things that will make people think in a slightly greener way. And I hope that will help us to work much more effectively internationally towards climate change.
Okay, well, we've sort of come to the end of our half hour now, which always goes so quickly. But let me ask you finally, if anybody wanted to know more about this or to make contact with you or anyone who would be relevant, how would they go about doing it?
Well, they're more than welcome to email me. That's fine. It's just my name all run together lowercase. So that's Charlotte Gath, G-A-T-H the surname, then the curly @AOL.com. Very welcome to email me.
Okay, well, that's great. And I hope you don't get tons of emails.
I'll be surprised, but maybe.
No, I don't think you will. But anyhow, at least people know. Anyhow, thank you for doing this because that's really
You're
interesting. I
welcome.
think it really is important to explore public health, not just for, you know, what it was in the past, what it is now in the pandemic, but for the future and the crises that we almost inevitably will have. So thank you for doing it because I think it's been, you know, really worthwhile and really interesting. So, you know, we'll end this interview now.
Okay, thank you very much, Francis. Thank you.